Hi, welcome to Forensic Forecast, your, well, I would say weekly dose, but that's not necessarily true. Your semi-regular dose of...
Occasional dose.
Yes. Semi-occasional, whatever. Dose of forensic, digital forensic news and happenings, interviews and, well, all that fun stuff that you enjoy. The reason you come back month after month. So... How are you doing, Simon?
I'm doing quite well.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear. Done anything fun and entertaining recently? Annoyed any other countries that you visited? Or?
No, I haven't really been anywhere since. Just kind of annoying people around me, really. It's just wherever I go.
Yes, one can testify to that. So, you may remember that some months ago, we talked about Operation Ore. This is quite a large police investigation, international police investigation, involving the Avon and Somerset police. Now, yep. Do you remember what happened last time we talked about it, Simon? Some important developments had been going on.
Yeah, essentially, we had two experts, one whose reputation wasn't in the best of conditions at the time, going to they went to a police station, didn't they? And they took away copies of hard drives, only to have police decide that they shouldn't have them and go and seize them off them later on.
Yep. So Operation Ore was quite controversial in the first place before this happened, and now it's really controversial. The two people involved were Jim Bates and Chris McGee, and as Simon said, Jim Bates. He wasn't acting as an expert witness. He was acting as a consultant, and Chris McGee was the expert involved. And what happened is that in June, they went and they took these images of the computer, thinking everything was fine. The police had let them do it. They didn't try to hide anything, only for their homes and their businesses to be raided. And it wasn't just their computers that were taken, but it was also computers that were involved in evidence for other cases which were taken. And the thing which was quite interesting about that, the most recent developments, is that a judge has overturned the what he's done is that he said the original warrant which was issued didn't cover everything which you did there. So you've overstepped your bounds. You've seized all this stuff, which has nothing to do with your investigation against these people whatsoever. And then he went even further, and he said, you need to return all this property that you've taken, because it doesn't belong to you. It doesn't belong to the person that you've taken it from. It belongs to their clients. So it's quite incredible, this, I think. And I, for one... I'm very happy to see that this has happened, if I'm completely honest.
Yeah, I think sometimes, on either side of the way you look at it, people can overstep the mark sometimes, and it's good to see that there are judges and the like out there who are going to be willing to stand up and say, you know what, you got that wrong.
The thing that worries me about this now is that this is a High Court judge that said this. Okay, he's rolled everything back. Mr. Justice Owen, Lord Justice Richards and Mr. Justice Owen, they said that the search carried out of the forensic expert Jim Bates was unlawful, saying they had to return all the property, like I said before. Now, for whatever reason now... Avon and Somerset police are refusing to comply with this. They're saying, essentially, that if they give the stuff back to Jim Bates, then they'll be breaking the law. They can be accused of distribution of indecent pictures of children, and they can be prosecuted individually for that. Now, I don't know what you think about this, Simon. I think that's the stupidest argument I've ever heard in my life. I know that there's laws governing the control of this kind of material, but using that as an excuse to not do as a judge has ordered you, aren't you just signing away your career at that point as a police officer?
Yeah, well, the thing to bear in mind is the very active looking at this kind of stuff is still an illegal act, isn't it, really? And there's provisions made in the legal system for people to deal with these things.
Yeah.
And so throwing that up as an argument is a bit ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, let's look at it another way, shall we? I mean, I think most people who listen to this know that we are subcontractors for the police, and we analyse the computers. Now, if you draw, a parallel here, every week or every couple of weeks, we send out a delivery driver to pick up computer and phone cases to bring back to our offices for analysis. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference? What's the difference there? They are distributing indecent pictures of children to us.
Yeah.
That means that they should all be prosecuted, and we should be prosecuted. And that this kind of work essentially needs to stop, because even inside the police, you're going to, an officer in the case sends computers away for investigation. Regardless of where he sends it, even if it's internally, he can still be done for distribution of indecent pictures of children. Like you said, there's provisions in the law which stop this from happening. And it's not just with this kind of material. It happens with drugs, with stolen property. All that stuff moves around freely inside the justice system, quite happily, without anybody kicking up a fuss about it. Because,
well, it has to, really, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Otherwise, people can't
it couldn't function.
Have a fair trial. And nothing would even ever get to trial, to be fair. No. So if people couldn't actually do these things with provision made within the law for them to do it, then obviously prosecutions would never be brought against this. And I guess more and more people would do it anyway, wouldn't they? Because they knew they'd never get caught.
Yeah. Well, it's just, I don't get it. I mean, there's obviously, this Operation Ore is obviously a deep underlying, there's obviously deep underlying feelings there between the Avon and Somerset police and the people who oppose them. And you just think, that how can you possibly get a fair trial as one of these defendants if the police are insistent on trying to stop any defence people, whether it be consultant or expert or whatever else you want to call them, if they're just going to hamper their efforts, then, first of all, it's going to prolong things until these people are actually able to go in and get a fair hearing. Second of all, they're not really guaranteed a fair hearing anyway. The best thing to do is for the police just to go, give the stuff back, let the trials go ahead, and that way people will either be convicted of what they're accused of, or they won't be. People then go to prison, or they get on with their lives. There's no point in having people sitting in limbo for this amount of time over something as stupid as this. This is wasted a year of what could have been done in the meantime. That's a long time. If you're accused of something and you feel you're accused wrongly, a year can be a hell of a long time to wait until somebody comes in and says, look, I'm sorry, it was a mistake, you're off the hook. I mean, it's ludicrous.
Well, even if you look at it from the other point of view, if someone's been doing something illegal, regardless of what the illegal activity might be, if you spend a year faffing around when you could be putting evidence together for court or whatever, what's to stop the person being out there on bail somewhere, carrying on doing the illegal things that they're doing?
Yeah.
And thereby making the situation worse.
It's not been a year, I apologise. It was September when that happened originally. I thought that had gone, I thought it was a quick year, to be honest.
It's not that far off, I suppose.
No, but it's still a long time, isn't it? And I think it's Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset, is still holding firmly to his belief that he shouldn't give the stuff back. And this is a high court judge. There's only... In this country, there's only... The only court higher than the high court is the House of Lords.
Yep.
And not many cases go to the House of Lords, let's face it. I mean...
No.
You know, this is a big deal. And if this guy doesn't get his act together and agree to put to give these things back, he himself could get a criminal conviction. It boggles the mind. Just let it go. Anyway, moving on. We see stories like this roll around every now and again. A British telecom investigation into eBay hard drives has found that a number of drives that were bought on eBay by the company contain US Air Defense launch secrets.
Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah. How does this happen?
Well, it starts with a Muppet who puts stuff unencrypted on a hard drive, who then has a moment of madness where they decide to get rid of it and possibly pass it on to another Muppet who will then sell it on eBay.
Yes. I mean, these hard drives contained the test launch procedures for THAAD, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, ground-to-air missile defense system, which was used in Iraq for the Scud missiles. And this... It's just ludicrous. I don't know. Just going back to statistics just quickly, it said BT found that 34% of hard drives that were bought and examined from eBay contained either personal information or commercial data identifying the company and organisation where the hard drive came from, which in and of itself is quite dangerous. I don't think there's anybody who listens to this podcast that would consider, if they were selling a computer on or a hard drive, that would even consider just giving it away the way it was instead of properly wiping it.
I wouldn't have thought so.
It should be second
nature. If by any chance there are, don't do it.
Yes. You're nuts if you do it. And you deserve what you get, in my honest opinion. No, I'm being serious now, because if you know better... If as a forensic investigator, you know exactly what can be pulled off a hard drive, whether it's been formatted or not, whether it's been, you know, fiddled around with a little bit, or whether it's been completely wiped. You know, if it's been completely wiped, the chances are you're not getting anything off that drive. No one else can get anything off that drive. But if you send off a hard drive to somebody who says, oh, I need a new hard drive, you got a spare one, yeah, go ahead. And that's got your personal details on, and they then find those things and use it against you. I'm sorry, but you deserve it. It's hard, but, you know, you'll learn a lesson that way. It might be an expensive lesson, but it'll be a lesson learned. And to be honest, the US government deserves to be embarrassed by this for what they've done. I know that it's not their procedure to have these things on a hard drive typically, but they ended up on a hard drive. So they have to find the person who's responsible for this and make an example of them.
The problem is that... It'll be the same in the military there as it is here and everywhere else, anywhere with any kind of security. They have procedures in place to make sure these kind of things don't happen. But people are lazy and people don't want to go through all these things. They don't want to encrypt data they put on a hard drive, because then they've got to go through the hassle of connecting it to something and opening up a program and running something and entering in a key to unencrypt it, and it all takes time. So people kind of work around things, and that's the problem. It's not the procedures, it's the fact that people don't follow them.
Yeah. No, I agree. And we see data breaches all the time over here. Constantly, even. Every couple of weeks, there's, some more data's been lost. Your personal lives are essentially owned by hackers all over the world. And you think, what's the point? What's the point of having procedures if they're not followed? They need to find out who did this, and they need to be put in front of a judge, in front of a jury, and they need to be sent to prison because it's gross misconduct. And stuff like that can be pretty damn dangerous.
Well, yeah, if you think about if if this had gotten to the hands of someone who knew what they could do with this information.
Yeah.
It could have been pretty bad for them.
Yeah. This little article also says that back in April 2006, there was an incident of a flash drive with US spy data being sold in an Afghan bazaar for just under $40. And it's just, why are these things being allowed to slip out? It's insane. And new this week, the Forensic Science Service here in the UK is going to cut, according to some reports, of up to 40% of its 1,900 member workforce. They say that around about 800 jobs are at risk in England and Wales. And the Forensic Science Services, I know this doesn't relate directly to digital forensics, but they do have some tie-ins. I think, aren't they something to do with a serious organised crime?
Yeah. They'll have people who work in digital forensics within that staff, I'm sure they will.
Oh, I'm sure they will as well. They're best known for like fingerprinting and DNA and stuff like that, but they do also have their, like Simon says, they've got their hands in a few pies, and one of them happens to be digital forensics. And one of the things which which is quite worrying is that the rumours are for this is that the reason they've done this is to make it look more appealing for potential buyers. So we have a government wing of something which they're looking to sell and offload. And I'm not particularly sure how comfortable I am with that, to be perfectly honest.
No, it would be nice if it stayed kind of state-owned, really, wouldn't it? But yeah. It's what the government like to do, isn't it? When they need money, like what can we sell?
And also, talking of politics, some brilliant news. We just had our European parliamentary elections here. And Simon, do you want to tell us an interesting little thing which happened there?
Well, over here, I guess people used it as an opportunity to send a message to our current government saying, you don't know what you're doing, thereby not really voting for them. But other countries have possibly taken some things a little bit further, I suppose. For example, in Sweden, the Pirate Party has won a seat in the European Parliament.
Okay, so there's talk that the Pirate Party has won this seat in the European Parliament because of what happened with the Pirate Bay directly just a couple of months ago. The Pirate Party have basically they won 7.1% of the votes in Sweden.
That's crazy, isn't it?
That's an incredible number of people. Well, obviously, I don't know how big
it
Sweden is.
It depends on on the turnout.
Yeah.
And I watched the first three votes that came in for the UK, and out of 2 million people, I think 400,000 voted or something.
Yeah, I think I heard that between the ages of 13 and 35, that it was like 40% voter, 40% of those guys voted for the Pirate Party. So it's actually quite some. Just a quote here from party leader Rick Falkvinger. I know it's wrong, but still. Together, we have today changed the landscape of European politics. No matter how this night ends, we have changed it, Falkvinger said. This feels wonderful. The citizens have understood it's time to make a difference. The older politicians have taken apart young people's lifestyle bit by bit. We do not accept that the authorities' mass surveillance, he added. I didn't see it. That sentence didn't seem to make any sense at all at the end, to be honest.
No.
But,
bearing in mind, this is probably translated from Swedish.
Yeah, probably by a Swedish person, no less. So, yeah, they get a seat on the European Parliament. But what does that mean, though? I mean, a lot of people in the US doesn't really understand what the European Parliament is, Simon. Do you want to shed some light on that?
You know what? I'd like to say I know what the European Parliament really do.
There's only one reason I pushed that question to you as well. Because I don't know. I don't know what the European Parliament does. All I know is that we get stupid rules and regulations passed down to us about your bananas can't be more than this length and can't be this curvy. Otherwise, not real bananas. Straight. And you can't call Kendall mint cake Kendall mint cake unless it's come from Kendall. Brilliant
and in
stuff.
Fact, Cadbury's dairy milk chocolate doesn't have enough chocolate in it for you to call it chocolate.
Oh, dear. So,
I think you've actually managed to identify what it is that European Parliament actually does. And that's really not a lot of stuff that's useful as far as we're concerned.
Yeah. Apparently, just looking further down, it says that Sweden has 20 seats. This is going from Torrent Freak. Sweden has 20 seats, but until the Lisbon Treaty passes, only 18 with voting rights. This means the Pirate Party will have 2 seats instead of just the 1. Oh, dear. And the German Pirate Party got 1% of the votes in that country. All right, well, we'll step down off the soapbox for a little while. I had the privilege of interviewing Rob Lee from Sans Forensics, and following is the interview that I had with him. Enjoy. Hi, Rob, how are you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm doing
real
pretty good.
Pleasure to be here, thank you.
All right, well, we're very glad to have you on the show. We've asked Rob to come on today because in a few weeks' time, there's the SANS Forensic Summit coming up, and we thought it'd be good to get him on the show and tell us a little bit about it and try and encourage people to go along. So, first of all, Rob, a lot of people have seen you knocking around like on Twitter and on the SANS Forensic blog and everything else. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you get into the field to start with?
Well, I was auditioning for the Blue Man Group. And actually, it's funny you mention that on Twitter because people think that that the look on my face, it says, well, you should be a part of the Blue Man Group. So I'm now, if this forensics thing never works out, I actually pretty sure I have a second career being lined up, being a part of that, but being part of that entourage. I think I do a pretty good job of it too. So we'll see. How did I get into forensics? I actually been doing forensics for, oh, geez. I pretty much since 1998, 11 years ago, I've been doing information security since about 1995, even before I graduated school. And I was in the Air Force and I was working at a unit, from 96 to 98 called the 609th Information Warfare Squadron in, South Carolina at 9th Air Force. And we pretty much, cut our teeth on, what was then known as NetRanger, which was a, network intrusion detection device, which Cisco later bought out by the Wheel Group. And during my time down there, I was picked up and recruited by the Air Force Office of Special Investigations to come up and head the team called the Technical Monitoring Team. It's called the TMTs. And this team is comprised of about 5 or 6 individuals that assisted the investigations, national level intrusions against Air Force systems, in which we primarily did a lot of the network wiretaps, as well as the initial triage acquisition, as well as some forensics analysis as well. We were pretty close, closely aligned at what was then the DOD Computer Forensics Laboratory, DCFL, which they've created a couple tools which are well-known, DSUFL-DD, for example. So I spent a better part of 3 years working with AFOSI, and then ended up leaving the Air Force in 2001, mainly because there was really not a career track for individuals in who have, like a security, like a information security or information analysis background like I had. And so I ended up becoming a government contractor for the U.S. For about 6 years, working for a company called Mantech, which ended up being kind of like an Air Force retirement village for everyone from the AFOSI. We all ended up going to the same company. And during my time there, I was working as a contractor for various government agencies, which, ended up, I had a relatively low profile at that time. intentionally so. I really wasn't trying to make a lot of news or headlines or, you know, release a lot of tools. But while I was doing that, I started on the side teaching for the SANS Institute, a computer forensics course, and that course, you know, became a 6-day track, which is now what you see it about 8 years later, a full, a lot of people have taken it at this point. I don't know, probably about 1,000 a year have gone through this track, and we're currently about expanding it into about 6 different tracks. So during that time, after I was a government contractor, and so I was working for SANS, I decided to go more commercial, and I now work part-time for a company called Mandiant here in Alexandria, Virginia, and I also work part-time for the SANS Institute. So that pretty much takes up the majority of my time at this point.
Very cool. What's the split then? I mean, you say you do – are you basically 50-50 between them or
– It depends, honestly, on how you look at it, because what essentially I'm in a transition right now. I was working on getting my MBA for the past 2 years. So I was working on the side for SANS and Mandiant. So it's hard to say it's 50-50. In the terms of amount of time I was spending between both of them, is probably about 50-50 then, yeah, during a lot of that time. But especially in the past year, I've developed a new course. So during the new course development cycle, it probably leaned a little bit more toward the SANS Institute, be able to help them out and work, be able to expand their curriculum. And now I'm looking at going back to working full time with Mandiant here in just a few short months.
Very cool. So, quite often you find people who have dedicated like a lot of time to teaching, but not as much to the actual investigation side of things. Do you think that has an impact on people?
Oh, completely. I mean, it's definitely had an impact on me while I was in school mainly, but I was still trying to keep my feet and hands into it, and especially keeping up to – it's hard to keep – as you well know, it's hard to stay on top of all of the recent developments, and you almost have to have a full-time job of someone staying abreast of the latest technologies. And as a result, not only the latest technologies and how to solve crime, but the latest trends in what's going on in the field. Primarily, the good thing about Mandiant and what they have been able to expose me to is two different types of crimes that are currently going on. First, a lot of making headlines are the Chinese intrusions against a lot of different systems in the United States. And we're not talking just potentially government systems. We're talking – if you have a company that has any intellectual property, the Chinese, which is better known as in our circles as the Advanced Persistent Threat, the APT – we've been doing massive level enterprise level response and forensic investigations. In addition to the other side of the coin is the financial related attacks that are currently originating from Eastern Europe, Russia and Ukraine, that are targeting banks and are, you know, extremely coordinated, extremely sophisticated, that are basically swiping millions of dollars from banks around the world. I mean, Germany and other countries have really stepped up their efforts to try and stop what a lot of these intrusions are basically doing.
Wow. It's, you know, I mean, I've done forensics for a couple of years now, but I mean, that kind of thing sounds a bit beyond me, to be perfectly honest.
It's, you know, we have, you know, I would say the average incident responder that comes in and starts working in Mandiant cuts his teeth rather relatively quickly because of the steep learning curve. And they become some of the best guys. I mean, they're teaching me so much about, like, what these guys are doing. I mean, for example, the Chinese, you know, one of the easiest techniques that the Chinese are doing to move around from system to system is merely copying themselves to an open share from on another, you know, peer system, and then scheduling a job to run through the scheduler and just saying, execute that tool on the remote system at 3 p.m., and that's how they're doing remote exploitation. I mean, it's some of the simple techniques that are out there, and it sometimes takes, you know, a lot of these guys really say, hey, do you really need to be that sophisticated to do this level of intrusion, or do you just need to be patient and really know what you're potentially, how you're going to move from system to system? And that's why, you know, it's not a problem of technology. It's a problem of scale. And in a lot of what the folks at Mandiant are currently dealing with, is we are investigating systems that are in numbers of hundreds of systems instead of a single system. And the FBI and Department of Justice are really have their hands full in doing a great job, by the way, but responding to these. But they have their hands full trying to say, well, we've typically done single system forensics. The real question is that how do we do forensics against multiple systems? How do we do it all at the same time and also still keep evidence intact and potential for prosecution, all these other things that could come up? And between both types of criminal, which one is more of the what we call the smash and grab, which they'll come in and grab something of interest, like they're grabbing credit card numbers, PCI data is what we call payment card information, or on the economic front that they that they're persistent, that they're it seems that their main purpose is retaining access, and as well as exfiltrating data. So you have both that are it's extremely interesting, but at the same time, the level of, the technology surrounding the level of criminal these days is a lot more than, we're way beyond the script kiddies of the early 2000s, which was mainly what we investigated in the Air Force OSI.
Wow. So as far as the scaling goes, do you fall back on something like NCASE Enterprise, or is there another enterprise product that you use for investigating?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. And I'm going to have to go on officially on the record here and saying the Mandiant has our own tool that we use. That's our own enterprise tool called Mandiant Instant Response. And MIR is just it's a controller, a rack-mounted controller that has remote agents that sit on the client systems that you're able to do pretty much anything that a normal forensic investigator would do via that agent, including full memory analysis and, be able to do process listings, pretty much anything that you potentially could imagine. I want to check to see if a specific registry key exists on 100 systems. Go. For example, I would like to see if a file matching this specific MD5 sum exists. So what we're able to do with MIR in a lot of these instances is deploy it when we're doing instant response to one of these sites, the enterprise network, and we're able to deploy the agents remotely and then query the agents because, with our experience and what we're battling with both the financial attacks as well as advanced persistent threat, we're able to get data fairly quickly on what is the scale of this compromise, how many systems are potentially currently owned. And it's a combination of two things. First, we may have an inkling of how they got on the system in the first place. Maybe that's how it was detected. Or the second is, because of our experience, we now actually have a signature list that we are using to help identify potential systems that are compromised. One of the things that we're currently doing at Mandiant is almost, how you do penetration testing and assessments to see if you're vulnerable. Well, we're doing a step beyond that, saying, do you actually know if you're compromised? We actually could come in to a site with MIR, drop it on your network, take a look at the profiles that we know exist because they don't change that much. It's actually pretty it changes enough that we are staying abreast of it, but we would be able to tell if that network is compromised just using the signatures that we already know about. It's almost like a advanced version of Tripwire or something like that, where we have we're using it more for intrusion assessment. And are you compromised is the question. And some banks and other institutions are afraid to ask that question, but they kind of know something's wrong, so they still bring us into really set us down and say, we need to figure this out. We just don't know where to look. Can you help us?
Very cool. That sounds like it could be a conversation in and of itself, really.
It's a great product. And granted, it is a Mandiant product. It's what we use. In order to, to answer your question, in order to do that scale of investigation, going back to the scaling part of that, you would need even a bare bones enterprise level capability. And you could, in some cases, which we've advised clients before, if you need to do that, you could use a combination of PSExec and a bunch of other tools, cobble them together, and you have a basic level of a capability. But to do true scaling, you probably need a true enterprise level tool that's out there.
Yeah,
And there's a couple other than the guidance softwares in Case Enterprise, which is a phenomenal tool in itself. I don't want to say only by Mandiant, but at the same time, Mandiant's tool is geared for intrusion-related forensics.
Yeah, there's obviously more than just the one. I mean, we've had Matt Shannon on the show before as well, talking about F-Response.
Yeah, F-Response is a great tool. Matt Shannon has a phenomenal level of capability there in his tool, and it's something I actually toyed around with a little bit last year, and I'm excited to see his current developments on that.
Yep. No, it's might have to have you or someone else in Mandiant on the show again just to talk about that even, I suspect. So
yeah, it's a fun thing to talk about, especially when you start getting into the true capabilities behind it. I just barely touched upon some of the things you could do with it or how we're currently using it. But Mir is it's a product that just came out last year, and it's already basically kicking a lot of hacker behinds across networks, and it really helps out in these massive investigations. Yeah, you cannot do that level of scaling without such a product.
Fantastic. All right, well.
So that's what I've been doing.
busy, obviously.
And yeah, basically my wife thinks I have 2.5 jobs, which is probably pretty accurate, the amount of times I actually spend in my office.
So how is it you found time to put together the Forensic Summit then?
I don't know. It's really funny because in the past a couple of years, I was getting my MBA at Georgetown University. And then I just graduated in April, and while at the same time working the two jobs with Mandiant and Sands, while teaching, while working, and at the same time, we're having these, things like the summit, I'm trying to organize in the background. And on top of that, I wrote a new course. And so I don't know how I did it, but I did it. But and I'm not divorced yet either, so all those things add up. But the summit, it's going to be a great time this year. One of the things that I'm finding, especially when I'm going out to any customer sites or just even talking to people in classes who are doing forensics, is that there's and this goes back into what is the point of this year's summit compared to last year. Last year, we talked a lot about the advanced persistent threat and how to combat dealing with large-scale enterprise-level forensic investigations, which is definitely more cutting-edge, but it's a niche area. It was fascinating to hear the conversations that, where are things leaning toward. But this year, we decided to take a stab a slightly different direction. What we did is we're asking the question, what are the basics that you need to know in order to do a proper forensics investigation today in the year 2009? It kind of falls along the lines that back in when I first started back in 1998 doing actual forensic investigations, that you had a hex editor, you had DD, you had maybe a couple of tools that were out there. I remember my first forensics class I ever took, we were using Norton utilities, as our primary tool to do undeletion from file allocation tables, file systems. But NTFS, no capability. Unix, they pretty much said the file's freaking gone. There's no way to recover a file on any type of Unix system, which we all know is, that's actually not true. But so a lot of what we're doing forensically was actually decided back in the year 1998 to the year 2000. So my question is now to the attendees and as well to the speakers, what are the basics? Has that changed? What do you as an entry-level investigator or an advanced investigator have to have under your belt in terms of skills, capability, to be able to do any type of forensics case from e-discovery all the way down to full-up intrusion analysis? So we're hoping to answer a lot of these questions through a series of panels and expert presentations.
Fantastic. So one of the things that I often have a conversation with people about in terms of digital forensics is, the more I learn, the less I actually know.
the funny thing is, when I first started doing forensics, Ed Skotis, who's another one of the my friends, and he's an instructor at SANS who teaches the hacker exploits track, and you may have also experienced this. I'm curious. I'm going to ask you, which is easier? Have you done, by the way, let me ask you first, have you done any Linux or Unix-based investigations or forensic cases?
I have. They're few and far between, though.
Well, let me ask you a question. Which is more difficult, Unix or Windows, to investigate?
Well, I would say Unix or Linux because I'm not as familiar with that as I am with
that. Well, that makes a huge difference. When I first started, most of our cases were Unix related, and what we found was initially when I found, started doing my first Windows cases, I was all excited because I thought it would be a lot easier. But because of the GUI and because of the intricacies of Windows, I found it was a lot less straightforward. Everything on Unix is usually from the command line. There's text files.
Yeah.
Pretty easy to tell, slight modifications to the system. But as soon as we went over to Windows, because of undocumented APIs, because half the stuff no one even knows about, because of the oddity surrounding, the non-documented NTFS, trying to get a true picture of what happened on a machine or be able to prove something happened was a lot more difficult than originally people had envisioned. Same thing for anyone who's out there done any computer hacking. Usually you start off in the Unix world and then you work your way over to Windows because it ends up Windows, depending on your case type, it ends up being a little bit more challenging. For being able to gain a foothold, to be able to, do investigations as well as what is happening in the registry, what's going on there, a lot of different things that are out there. So Windows, it's a fun, when you go beyond just email investigations, but it ends up being so complex that every day I'm on doing a case, I find myself being consistently surprised and also always learning, just like you said. It's you never stop learning, and that's why I really, truly love forensics.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, I feel exactly the same. When you talk about the summit, you mentioned about speakers and panel members. Who have you got lined up for the discussions at the summit?
Well, a better question that you should probably ask is who don't we have lined up? We actually,
I've seen the list already.
I think I pulled every string in favor out there to get as many of the folks I know in the field out there. In fact, last year, a lot of the folks who were coming to the summit in 2008 had never met each other. And it was from the speakers and panelists, they loved the summit just because they finally got to sit down and have drinks and go to dinner with a lot of their peers in the industry that, up until now, they'd only conversed with on Twitter, Skype, maybe email. Maybe the forum somewhere, but they never really sat down and met. So it was really good for all of them. So some of the folks that we have coming to the summit this year, we have Richard Baitlick, who's doing a keynote. Richard and I, both ex-Air Force, I knew him in the Air Force, really good dude. He's also a graduate of my alma mater, the Air Force Academy, so cannot say enough about what he's doing on his end. He has the blog at Tau Security, which, by the way, if you ever want another good interviewer interview, I would contact Richard to see his thoughts on things too. We have several panels that are set up. We have Chris Arms, Harlan Carvey, who just had a new book released, which I think you're having him on the show in a couple weeks, right?
Yeah, I'm gonna be speaking to him tomorrow. So,
oh, see, there you go. Dave Hull, who is one of our instructors at SANS and a really good guy. He's doing a lot of cases out in Kansas. Chris Pogue, and we also have Ken Bradley, who is working for Richard Baitlick. And that's our instant response panel right there. On our forensics panel, we have Jesse Kornblum, which a lot of folks know out in the field because he's written such wonderful tools such as MD5 Deep and SS Deep. Also had his also was in conjunction with I forgot the name right off the top of my head, but he wrote Foremost, which is a forensics tool a lot of people use. Troy Larson, which is from Microsoft, because I wanted to balance it his views. He's a little bit quieter in the industry, but he is phenomenal in his level of knowledge and his connections inside what's going on in the Windows system. Mark McKinnon, he's going to be coming, and Jess Garcia from who's the CEO of One Security.
You got Lance Mueller as well, haven't you?
Go ahead.
Lance Mueller as well.
Lance actually just wrote me, unfortunately he's not going to be able to attend. He has to be at a client site in Asia, which I was about to ask several questions beyond that. I'm like, no, maybe I should.
He gets around so much. I spoke to him the other day, and he's in Asia, then he's going to Mexico, then back to Asia, and I'm like, dude, Well, how do you find time to breathe, let alone do anything else?
I really don't know how he does it. He travels a heck of a lot. Really good guy, though. I mean, I could tell he really wanted to be there, but yeah, he just bowed out because, in this situation, customer comes first. And since we're all instant responders and, you know, we live and eat and breathe and die by our ability to respond to our customers' needs, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if someone else bows out by the time the summit rolls around just because of the way things are rolling. We also have from Mandiant, Jamie Butler and Peter Silberman, who are going to be talking about their capabilities for memory analysis, as well as Brendan Dolan Gavitt. He's going to be doing memory analysis. And then we have a bunch of law enforcement folks coming. Ovi Carroll is going to do our keynote for the second day. And Ovi is the Ovi and Brett do the CyberSpeak podcast. Yep. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to mention someone else's podcast on.
Go for it.
Your podcast. By the way, you guys should interview each other. You know, like you host the other podcast, right? but those, it's really funny because last year someone made the comment and said, how come all the guys that do forensics or are up there are ex-Air Force OSI guys, which, you know, Ovi's ex-Air Force OSI, as well as Jesse and about three or four others who are going to be speakers. And I said, well, all of us are bald, first of all, so you have to shave your heads. And, you know, of course, Harlan's up there. He, myself, Ovi Carroll, Richard Baitlick, we basically all, like, you know, had solar panels all showing. And then, of course, there's Brett Padres. And have you met Brett before?
I haven't actually really met anyone, to be perfectly honest.
Well, if you see a picture of Brett, he looks like a he has enough hair on his head that we could share it amongst all four of us and still have some left over. So he's a really good guy. He's ex-Air Force OSI, but Brett was up there. And I pointed out that if you're really doing forensics and you're serious about this, you actually don't have time to wash your hair. That's why we all shave our heads. And we all look at Brett at this point, and he's like, what? So we have a bunch of folks from the law enforcement side, a lot of federal. I tried to get every federal arm represented, including Postal, who's going to be there. Postal, FBI, Secret Service will all be there. We also have folks from the DC-3, Josh Black will be there. We have a bunch of local guys as well, local guys and gals, who are going to be on that panel, which will be a really good panel to go to. And then the final part of the afternoon on the second day, we have a forensic challenges in the courtroom, which I brought a lot of the folks that are doing a lot of testimony, expert witness work, who have a lot of direct experience with courtroom testimony, evidence presentation, to really answer a lot of the questions that folks are going to be finding if they ever have to present evidence in court. Craig Ball, who's an attorney and a computer forensic expert, is going to be there. Larry Daniel, Gary Kessler, Dave Kleiman. A lot of these guys are, including Doug White, are really renowned for their basically their expertise in both the computer forensics field, but as well as their expert witness testimony work. And the final part of the day on the last day is we're going to have Owen Casey, who's a new SANS instructor too, by the way, talk about his mobile device forensics. And he's going to do a presentation on what he's learned on you could do memory analysis even on mobile devices. It's really phenomenal the level of activity that he's currently doing on mobile device forensics. So he's going to be presenting on that. So we have it's going to be a fascinating 2 days, which for the attendees, it's going to be a real good time to really sit down with a lot of these guys in the field who, you know, we're peers in this, you know, including the attendees, because a lot of the things we really don't know ourselves. And like you said, you know, it's like you're constantly learning, and the attendees themselves who ask questions to the panelists, you know, I guarantee something will come up that will really create a great learning experience for everyone that will be there. So it's going to be a great time. You're going to be there, right?
I really wish I could. I tell you, we get screwed in this country. Let's face it. I mean, we got like one conference a year in November where it's cold and raining and snowing and who knows what else, and we're crammed into this tiny little hotel. We don't get anything.
Isn't the exchange rate between the U.S. and U.K. like half? So you can come over here and you can buy like a big screen TV for like $200.
No, it used to be. Not anymore. No.
I was in London about 2 years ago, and I remember ordering at a bar like 4 mojitos, and they were £10 each, and I just like, wait a minute, I just paid $20 per drink.
$80 on 4 drinks. That's insane.
That's insane. But the view was great. That's all I can say. The view was.
Better be for that much money. Holy cow.
Yeah, but it should be, you know, you got to get the exchange rate. We need to have that dollar really waiver again to get it more. So you could come over here and actually, yeah, I spent like £300 on this conference. What did you guys pay?
So are there still spaces open for the summit then?
Oh, yeah, there's we're really filling up fast. But, you know, usually the funny thing with the summits compared to a conference, a lot of people end up signing up at the last moment because it's only a 2-day commitment. And they end up saying, you know, I'm not doing anything the next 2 days. Why don't I just fly out to the summit, you know, go and sit there. And being in D.C. is where the summit's at. It is also a good location because it ends up being easy to get to. We have 3 airports here, but at the same time, D.C. just happens to be, you know, because of all the government agencies, a lot of people travel here for work anyways. So they can potentially get a work trip arranged around the time of the summit. So we have a lot of people coming, but at the same time, we have spots that are still open if you're interested in coming. Which, by the way, I'm going to go ahead and tell people that if you want, we don't have this up yet, but I'm going to get this up. We'll do a 10% discount for the listeners of the show. Does that sound
fantastic.
Okay?
Yeah, it's great. Oh,
okay, so what we'll do is we'll do a – what's a good code we could use? You know, if, forecast 10?
Yeah, sounds good.
All right, we'll do forecast 4 with like the number 4, cast 10 is the code you'll use. And I'll get that set up hopefully by the time that the show is rolled out.
Very cool. Yeah, I can hear Mark McKinnon kicking himself now, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's a speaker. He gets in free anyway.
Fair enough then. You didn't make him pay? Oh, dear.
Well, yeah, I know. People actually have to pay to hear him speak, which is, you know.
Cool stuff.
I know. I'm sitting there thinking, wow, we should have rethought that.
You're free for the minute, your minute and a half that you're speaking. The rest of the time you have to pay.
Yeah, exactly.
So, cool.
Here's my $50.
He's gonna hate me now.
Yeah, he'll definitely. Hi, Mark. We love you. It's kind of like the other day. We actually had someone asked me the question. What is your favorite forensics tool? And I'm like, oh, Mark McKinnon. Well, it's because Mark developed so many of the great tools out there. I was trying to tell them that you should check out Mark McKinnon's site, but it actually came out that I was saying Mark McKinnon is the tool.
Oh,
so Mark's site, by the way, which is a great site if you haven't found it, it's CFTED. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's you probably have a link on your website somewhere, don't you?
If you go to Red Wolf Computer Forensics.
Red Wolf Computer Forensics, okay, that's right. Is that one word?
Yeah, Red Wolf Computer Forensics, all one word. And there's a link to his blog on there. So,
see, Mark is now saying, okay, fine, insult me, now send people to my website. That's great.
Anyway, before I bury myself more here.
Yeah, I know. He's going to come on here to start twittering about this. Take you both down.
He used to play football, so he's a, you know.
Now, do you mean football or do you mean soccer?
No, I mean American football.
Okay, well, just, you never be clear.
He was like a defensive lineman or something like that. So he's, yeah. Don't turn your back on him when you're at the summit. He might take you down. So.
And of course, all the listeners who've met me is like, well, Rob's not that small of a dude either. Yeah. All right. Mark's a good guy. Yeah. He was giving me a lot of grief the other day on Twitter for something I'd said, and I almost got to the point, it's like, I really didn't offend you, did I? He's like, no, I just like giving it back about 10 times more than it was received. I'm like, okay, good, just checking.
Well, the good news for you is that he's agreed to come back on here after the summit and talk about what he's talking about there. So he's got his chance to get his own back on you anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So. That'll be fun. Good times.
Yeah. All right.
So we what are the questions you got?
So we're going to talk a little bit about the curriculum at SANS. You said before that there was going to be some expansion to that and possibly.
Yeah, it's at SANS there's several things we've done, you know, in addition to starting the summits for forensics, which, you know, as for anyone who's been around the community for many years, if you remember back in the early 2000 time frame, that SANS used to be more of a, you know, come listen to a bunch of speakers and hear their thoughts on information security. Then we went into more of a traditional teaching conference style, which with the summits, we're getting back to more of the, you know, like the free, have a bunch of speakers come in and give their current thoughts on the latest and greatest from the community. Well, getting back to the curriculum, in addition to expanding on the summits, we've really taken a stab at realizing that you cannot have a single course train everyone on all the different types of cases that they might encounter. So we had one core forensics course, which is the Computer Forensics Investigation Response, which is the course title for that is Security 508. And that was a course that's been around for about 8 years now. And we've expanded that course, and we have an essentials course that is basically a prequel course into Security 508, which is the Computer Forensics Essentials course. Now, this course is the one I spent the past 4 months writing. It's, you know, we have over 600 pages of brand new material, which basically cover your traditional crime forensics, you know, child exploitation, intellectual property theft. It's going to cover, you know, when you're someone who's a you know, an evildoer does something bad with a computer system, and they're not technically savvy, but, you know, it's, you know, can you tell that they stole IP? You know, how do you recover email? So we're basically focusing only on Windows machines in this new course, and we're having the user step through using FTK. We're actually providing, as a part of the tuition, a Tableau write blocker, wow, which does USB and SATA, I mean IDE and SATA, with all the different adapters for it, and be able to take them through what are the essential techniques that a user should know when they're doing forensics, which at this point when I totaled up the total number of slides, we have over 110 pages of material just on registry forensics. And that's why, you know, while people say it's an essentials class, they say, well, I know everything there. Well, don't be so, you know, so quick to think that, because we really are aiming this to be, here's what you should know for doing traditional crime forensics. And that's, you know, that's why it's going to be a very, very fun course for people to be able to go through and take. So that's our first new course that we've done. And 508 is slowly going to morph into an intrusion forensics course. You know, when you have someone who's technically savvy, they are, you know, sysadmin level type evil doer, that you have to up your game in order to investigate what they're doing. In addition to that, in 508, we also cover in-depth file system forensics, which we really try to get an individual to understand the different components of the file system, so you really understand what Encase is doing behind the scenes in case something happens to the tool, and you need to validate your piece of evidence by recovering it by hand. And that's actually, by the end of the course in 508, people are using hex editors and techniques by hand to do what Encase does in mere seconds, you know, the same type of analysis. But you could verify and truly understand and articulate conversationally how the file system's laid out by going through the intermediate course.
I think it's important to really know that, because anyone can push buttons and make Encase do, you know, funny things and whatnot. But if you get up in court and you have to explain exactly how Encase is able to do that, a lot of people could come and stuck there if they don't really understand the underlying principles. And I think it's important that, you know, people go back to that frequently and reteach themselves the basic things.
We hand out Brian Carrier's File System Forensic Analysis book in the course, which is a companion to the course itself, but it's that level of knowledge. And here's a good reference, you know, in addition to everything we teach you in here, you could look up a specific artifact in the file system to really understand and articulate what it's doing there and why it is useful to your potential case. And you're exactly right when you're saying there's a – you may be faced in an example in a courtroom where they ask you, well, specifically how did the pretty GUI recover that file? And you know, if your answer to that is, well, I pressed the button. You know, how are you going to retain your expert witness status in that courtroom? I don't know. I mean, that's where if you're getting in the expert witness side of things, you really should be able to articulate and communicate that extremely well in a courtroom. And it's technical, but you also need to be basically use a lot of the analogies that we go through in the classroom to be able to explain things in very clear and consistent way so that you're able to use the same analogies in the courtrooms to be able to get the jury nodding up and down in agreement with you.
Yep.
Go ahead.
No, go for it.
So in addition to the two core courses that we have, which those courses will probably be the main ones taught multiple different times throughout the year, including in the UK. We have a conference coming up here in November, which I believe 508 is going to be taught at, which is the intermediate level course. We also have four additional courses. We have network forensics. This course basically came out of Massachusetts Attorney General's office contacted me and said that they're having an issue basically responding to small businesses with this small network. They said they walk in there and they have a wireless access point, they have a firewall, and they look at these blinking devices like, well, how do I seize that as evidence? And you know, it's a great question. I'm like, what are the proper techniques to take down network devices? I don't know. I mean, half the time, I don't know that you know the right answer there. I mean, can you image a network device properly? Do you seize the entire box and replace it? You know, what do you do? And then how do you use the information on these devices to be able to piece together post-event something that happened? You know, what about a proxy that's there? You know, if it's a Squid proxy, you know, what types of information can you cull from the log files on, you know, a proxy or a firewall? So that course is primarily going to take people through the how to, you know, basically do acquisition and analysis of network-based evidence. One of the most important things to realize, you know, what is there a way to properly take down one of these devices in a small business, especially? So we have that class coming, and we also have mobile device forensics, which Owen Casey's writing. Who's really well known in the forensics community. And that course is going to be available in September. He's going to be covering everything from smartphones to iPhones, in addition to just regular old cell phones, you know, text messages, memory analysis of these devices, and other things, again, focusing on acquisition and analysis of mobile devices. And then we also are very proud to announce that we have Scott Moulton's course, which he was running outside of SANS, which is the data recovery, and we call it Drive-In Data Recovery Forensics is the official title of the course, which he takes individuals through how to basically bust open hard drives, repair it, put it back together, and fire it up. All, and this is the most shocking part of this, without a clean room. Now, you know, yeah, it's basically he teaches you how to do it and says if you're careful, you actually don't need a clean room to do basic repairs. And he takes everyone through there, whereas someone basically sitting through that course, he'll tell you even if you do this professionally, you should get a clean room. Here's how you could get a really cheap one even, you know, but he'll tell you exactly how to do it. But, you know, not to spoil the course, but it's a phenomenal course where you basically take apart and put back together at least at a minimum 5 hard drives throughout the week.
Ooh.
See, it's really cool.
That one sounds most appealing to me. Just for plain geeky reasons, I've got to be completely honest, but that does sound very, very cool.
It is a fun course. And he's starting to – this course is going to be available for the first time at SANS Fire in just a few weeks. And that's that course title is Drive and Data Recovery Forensics, titled Security 606. Again, it's more of an advanced, for the SANS level. It's an advanced class in which a lot of people have been doing forensics like yourself for a while would, say, hey, I'd really like to be able to do minor repairs without having to spend money and send it to a drive recovery shop. There's a lot of folks out there that really think that there's a magic behind, that there should be a, obfuscation of how to do this type of thing. Well, he's come up with techniques no one's seen before. For example, he has a gum, do they have Trident over there? Like in the packs with the metal foil?
Well, something similar, yeah.
Gum, yeah, okay. But it was basically he takes a strip of the Trident metal foil, he bends it over in half, and he uses that to separate the heads of the so they won't hit the platter when you're removing the platter. Stuff like that. It's like, it's just like, there are some easy ways to help the average person be able to do this type of work. And, he said that some of the students in the past have set up their own drive recovery shops in their towns as a result of this, and are making good business by doing this type of work. And it goes beyond just forensics. You could just repair hard drives by coming to this class. So it's so we're really trying to get a full-scale, real full-scope forensic analysis by being able to offer a lot of these different types of courses that are out there. In addition to the cutting edge, we definitely want to offer something that is brings people up to a level that it will make them cutting edge. Like the Essentials course, instead of just recovering email or recovering pictures, is what I've up till now has been considered the essentials of doing computer forensics. We're now saying you should, as a result of going through this course, you should be able to analyze link files. You should be able to analyze, EXIF data within, iPhone GPS coordinates out of an iPhone picture, registry analysis, all these things should be considered essential. So if someone plugs in a device, you should be able to track the exact time that device was plugged in. Those type of things are, what I'm hoping that the course is designed for, even like a paralegal who's technically oriented to be able to come in and take it, even if they've had no prior forensics training. So we're aiming to be able to take, like someone who's brand new to forensics and get them, geared up so they could do full-fledged forensics cases. Or in some cases, if a manager wants to come to a course and say, I'd really like to understand what my team is, doing on a daily basis, a manager could come take this course and really, have that full firm understanding. This is without getting into intrusion-related forensics, which definitely the experience side will help you. But, we wanted to really aim for a course that will get more people up to that essential level faster.
Okay, well, thanks for coming on to Forensic Forecast this week. We really appreciate it, Rob.
Oh, it's been fun. Thanks for having me on, Lee.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Where can people find you if they want to learn more about SANS and the summit and all the classes?
I'll be performing next with the Blue Man Group in a couple weeks. And yeah, after all said and done, no one's going to come to the summit. They're like, well, where's he at the Blue Man Group? But the information about all the SANS forensics activities can be found at forensics.sans.org, where you'll find a link to the forensics blog that SANS has, as well as the forensics summit under the events list. We also have a bunch of downloads and other cool things that you'll be able to explore that site. If you're on Twitter, we have my own personal one, which is Rob T. Lee. Make sure you don't forget the T in there. T is in Travis, actually, is my middle name. Rob Lee. I'm from Virginia right now, but there's a lot of Rob Lees in Virginia for some strange reason. I don't know. So Rob T. Lee is the Twitter for myself. And then SANS Forensics also has its own Twitter, which is just one word, SANS Forensics. Which links to a lot of different articles. I actually think I have it linked to your website for different blogging things that comes out to make sure that, any announcements that are up to date and that will actually news of in the forensics field will be released. So it's a good way to keep track of some of the latest developments.
Very cool. All right. Well, thanks again for coming on, and hopefully we'll have you back another time and we'll talk about some other stuff.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that.
All right. No problems. All right. Take care.
Bye.
Okay, so that was Rob Lee from Sans Computer Forensics. And we hope to have Harlan Carvey doing an interview for us next week. That's right. We're going to have another episode next week. And I know you're all saying, no, you're not. That's a lie. But it's true. We're going to try and push these out at least once every couple of weeks now.
I bet even you don't believe it.
I have a hard time. I'm starting to wake up in cold sweats at night and stuff, just thinking about it. But we're hoping there's enough material out there that it will keep us going. So, if Cyberspeak can... Oh, no, wait. Never mind. Ignore that comment. So, anyway, another thing I wanted to talk about today was the Forensic Forecast Awards. And
yay,
we're so happy.
I figured it needed that because I couldn't add a fanfare, so I needed to do something.
No, it sounded pretty miserable, to be perfectly honest.
All right.
But the reason I want to talk about this is because we think it's about time that there was some recognition in this field. There's lots of people who do many wonderful things for the field, day in, day out, all year long. And we've spoken to a couple of them on the podcast before. You know, Mark McKinnon for one and Matt Shannon for another. And today, Rob Lee. These guys work tirelessly. And why shouldn't they be recognised? Why should these actors who are paid, you know, millions of pounds for making substandard movies, have an award ceremony and we shouldn't? So,
amen.
Let's have an award for politicians.
I wouldn't want to think about the kind of awards we would hand out to politicians.
No, most manly looking woman.
There's tough competition for that one.
Oh, I know. So anyway. Focusing again. I think I've got ADD or something, honestly. So we've decided on a few different categories here, and I'm going to just talk briefly about each one. The Outstanding Contribution to Digital Forensics Individual category is for somebody, one individual who's made a tremendous impact on the forensic industry. The same for the next one down, but for Outstanding Contribution to Digital Forensics for a company. It can be a company that does forensic investigations. It can be a company that's created some software. It can be someone else even. It doesn't have to be somebody who is actually in the field necessarily. If there's a solicitor or a lawyer in the US or a judge or someone who's made a law which has made a significant contribution to this field, then they...
PI license.
Shh. Well, you had to do it, didn't you?
I figured it had to be mentioned somewhere. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, the contribution, Simon. It's supposed to be a contribution, not hindrance. Next is Best Digital Forensic Article/Blog Posting. You can vote for things on Forensic Forecast. I'm not saying it's mandatory, but we won't be accepting nominations for anything else. I'm kidding. This is going to be fair. No one's voting on anything on Forensic Forecast. So that can be written by anybody about any particular subject relating to the field. Then as Best Digital Forensic Blog, we thought this was a good one to put in because so many people have got so many good blogs which they keep updated with new information. I just think it's worthwhile to recognise one or two of these. Then we've got Best Digital Forensic Book, Harlan Carvey. yeah, just disregard that. then we've got Best Computer Forensic Hardware Tool, which, you know, it could be a write block, it could be a computer, a specific computer. It could be, you know, your favourite dongle or something like that, whatever you want to do. Best Computer Forensic Software Tool, whether it be FTK, NCASE, you know, X-Ways, F-Response, you know, Drive Profit, the list goes on and on and on. So whichever one you think is the best. Then we move on to the phones and best phone forensic hardware tool. Obviously, I don't know anything about that, and Simon knows a little bit about it. Best phone forensic software tool, which you can guess what that is from the title. Digital Forensic Examiner of the Year. And this is going to be somebody who isn't necessarily in the mainstream as much as like the bloggers and the book writers and everything else, but somebody who has performed admirably in their tasks of being a digital forensic examiner over the last year. So it might be somebody who you know personally, someone close to you. It might be someone who you admire and you look up to and you're looking to follow them in the field. But that's the one I think people need to take most time considering, to be perfectly honest. I think that
could be anyone, couldn't it? I mean, it doesn't have to be someone who's been published around the world for digital forensics. It can be just essentially anyone who you feel deserves some kind of recognition, can't it?
Exactly. And so that's that. And then the next one is quite similar, but we're going to aim this one to somebody who's been in the field for quite a long time and has got a lot of experience and who has made a significant impact over a sustained period of time on the industry. And that's the Lifetime Achievement Award. And we want to push those last two quite hard because I think they're probably the most important ones. But at the same time, I have a feeling they're the ones that people are going to vote on and nominate the least because they probably aren't quite sure on who to put in. But like Simon said, it could be absolutely anybody, so just go for it.
And then, it could be people who sit across from you in your lab. It could be anyone, really.
The person who sits across from me in the lab isn't going to get it, I tell you that much.
Hang on, I kind of sit across from you in the lab.
Oh. And then the last award is the Huh? Award. And that one, unfortunately, there's no nominations or anything for that one. Simon's going to pick that from one of the many humorous stories that he manages to find on the internet when he should be working. So,
yeah.
So
I mean, no.
So there are a few rules. What we're going to do is we're going to run nominations until the 21st of June. Nominations, have to email them to nominations@forensicforecast.com. And after the 21st of June, we'll tally them all up, and the top three in each category will go forward for voting. And the list of the nominees will be posted to the Forensic Forecast website 2 days later. And then there'll be, I think it's like almost 4 weeks of voting. I think it is exactly 4 weeks. 4 weeks to vote at that point. And the awards will be given to those with the most votes, as you would expect. Now, you cannot nominate or vote for yourself. That includes company that you work for, etc., etc. So, don't do that. If I find anyone doing that, you'll be vetoed completely, and all your nominations will be revoked.
You could have a name and shame bit, couldn't you?
I reserve the right.
When you publish the awards. This person tried to vote for themselves.
No, stop it. I'm not going to do that. And then each person...
I'd probably be in that.
I vote for Simon Whitfield. I vote for Simon Whitfield. Yeah, and they all have the same IP address. Yeah, if I get the feeling that anyone's tried to cheat the system, votes are going to be vetoed. And the winner in each category will be sent a digital trophy that I'm going to fashion. And they can place that on their website, their blog, on their email communications, or whatever they feel like, if they want to. You might not. It's entirely up to you. But you'll have won it, and that means something. We're trying to get this as much coverage as possible. I've posted it on Forensic Focus. I've put it up on LinkedIn, on Facebook. Talked about it on Twitter. And it's just out there. And I think quite a few people have already shown quite a lot of interest in it. Matt Shannon from F-Response has voted. Harlan Carvey's already voted. And other people have said, yeah, well, we're not voted, nominated, sorry, because it's only nomination time at the moment. So, yeah, that's all going to go hopefully according to plan, and hopefully on the 17th of July, once we've got all the votes in, we'll have a good idea of who's won, and then on the 19th of July, we're going to try doing a live broadcast. So you'll get to see exactly how many times we stop the tape while recording one of these by how many stupid things we say.
To be fair, we stop it a lot less than we used to.
Yeah, as time's gone on, we've got a lot better at it, so...
But we probably should stop it more than we do at the same time.
Yeah, I have a feeling this is one of those times. So, so yeah.
Basically, any time I'm talking.
What we want to do is what we want to do is try and spread the word a bit and get as many people involved in this as possible, because I think this is a big deal. I just think it's something which is overdue, and a lot of people are deserving of credit, and then they never receive it. So let's give some people some credit for once, and show how much we appreciate them and their hard work.
You never know, in a couple of years, if this takes off, we're going to have a glitzy awards ceremony somewhere.
Yes. I don't want to see you wearing that gold sparkly dress ever again, though, Simon.
Do you?
That's what I said. So for more details of that, you can go to forensicforecast.com, and there's a link to a post about the Forensic Forecast Awards just on the right-hand side of the page. So, Simon, let's have your and finally story for this episode.
Okay. Well, imagine to yourself, first of all, a man by the name of George Day, who lives in Birmingham, who was blinded at the age of 7 when sadly a brick hit him on the head. He received word from a friend. He was at work and received a phone call from a friend saying that the police were looking for him and had a warrant for his arrest. He was like, "What? What on earth for?" And he said, "Well, it's for driving offences." This is a guy who has never driven.
Obviously.
Because he can't.
Because he's blind.
Yeah. And yet, here we go. The police decided that they were going to go after him with this warrant for driving offences. And so he tried to persuade these people that, look, it couldn't possibly have been me. And I can prove it. And they're like, okay, well... We still have certain things we need to do, so that they still made this guy go to a magistrate's court and make a declaration that the police picked the wrong person. He had to arrange his own solicitor to be there. He had to book some time off work, and they didn't even give him a ride home afterwards.
That's
isn't
shocking.
It great?
That's disgrace. That's shameful, isn't it? I would find that funny if it wasn't for the fact that he had to fork out money himself to defend himself for such a ludicrous charge. Where was this again?
Birmingham.
In the second biggest city in the UK, something like this can happen. Brilliant. Well done. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
It's ridiculous, but yes. There you have it.
It is indeed. All right, well, we're going to call a stop there, I think, but thank you for joining us and sending those emails for your nominations, and hopefully someone will nominate you in return. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.